Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Rob. And I too would like to thank everyone for your participation in today's program. And this is a program that's done in collaboration with CARE, Share Cancer Support, and Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And today's title is Progress in the Treatment of Endometrial Cancer. And today's program is supported by iSci Inc., ChiroPharm Therapeutics, and through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc. And I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I would just like to let you know that we have over 205 participants on the call today who come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from a number of countries, Afghanistan, Australia, Canada, Ghana, Japan, the Philippines, Romania, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Flora Bacchus. And Dr. Bacchus is Professor, Fellowship Director, Director of Clinical Research, Division of Gynecologic Oncology, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the Ohio State University College of Medicine, the James Cancer Hospital and Solvay Research Institute. And Dr. Bacchus will be addressing an overview of endometrial cancer, including diagnosing, staging, and current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bacchus.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here. I'm really thrilled to give you a little bit of an overview and happy to answer questions at the end of these sessions too. So just to start with an overview of endometrial cancer, which starts with, of course, making the right diagnosis. Fortunately, most endometrial cancers are diagnosed at an early stage, and that is because they typically present with abnormal uterine bleeding. Most of the patients are have gone through menopause, so they're postmenopausal, and so once bleeding resumes after, or even if it's just a few spots here and there, but if that happens after menopause, that is not normal and should be investigated. But if you haven't gone, patients haven't gone through menopause yet, sometimes it can also present with abnormal uterine bleeding, meaning that periods have become irregular or very, very heavy, and also that warrants a biopsy. So workup oftentimes includes the pelvic ultrasound to take a look for how thick the lining of the endometrium is, the lining of the uterus, which is called the endometrium. And if that's thickened over normal, then a biopsy also would be warranted. However, if even if it's normal and the bleeding continues, still, there should be further investigation with, for example, a D&C or a dilatation and curettage to find out if there's any cancer cells inside the uterus, or maybe it's just bleeding from a polyp or some other origin. Of course, we also want to make sure that it doesn't involve the cervix or anything else. Then once the diagnosis is made of endometrial cancer, then the next step in treatment is going to be the staging procedure. And so, as I said, mentioned, most of these cancers are limited to the uterus, but they can spread to the cervix, to the tubes, the ovaries, the lymph nodes, and sometimes go also outside the lymph nodes to other organs, like the abdominal cavity, the liver, or the lungs. However, that's quite rare. So in most instances, there will be an CAT scan, probably, of the abdomen and pelvis involved. We don't always do that if the bleeding has just started early, but especially if the bleeding has been present for longer or if there's a biopsy that shows a higher grade tumor, then there's a higher risk that the cancer could have already spread, and a CAT scan before surgery is even more important. But the mainstay of surgery is still, the mainstay of treatment is still the surgery. So that would entail removing the uterus, the tubes, the ovaries, and then do an assessment of the lymph nodes also. In most cases, we can do these surgeries with minimally invasive surgery, either laparoscopic or robotic, so just a small incisions on the abdomen, and patients are able to go home same day or next morning. During the surgery, we remove obviously the uterus, as I mentioned, but then also typically nowadays don't remove all the lymph nodes in the pelvis or along the aorta anymore. We do something called a sentinel lymph node biopsy, meaning that we use a more precise method to really figure out which lymph nodes are the first draining lymph nodes, the sentinel or the gatekeeper lymph nodes. So we do that by injecting some dye into the cervix. The dye goes to the first or sentinel or gatekeeper lymph nodes, and we remove just those lymph nodes, so the lymph nodes that take the same path as the cancer cells do, without having to take the additional lymph nodes. And that is helpful in reducing the risk of complications, especially such as lymphedema, which is swelling that can in the legs that can be permanent. So lower risk with that. Then it takes a few weeks to get the pathology back, and then based on what the pathology shows, we're able to give this a stage, and that staging has just updated, been updated, but our pathologist on the call today will be able to go into that in a little bit more detail. Then as we have a stage, if this is an early stage, and we use a combination of factors, so how deep is it, what does the tumor look like under the microscope, how aggressive does it look, does it go into the wall of the uterus, did it go to the cervix, the tubes, ovaries, or the lymph nodes, that determines what stage it is, and that determines what treatments you would need. If it's all limited to the uterus and hasn't spread beyond that, and it's more like a grade one or a low grade cancer, then oftentimes no additional treatment is needed. However, if it's spread to the tubes, ovaries, or the lymph nodes, in that case, the cancer has a higher risk of recurrence, and then we would proceed with chemotherapy. So those are kind of the two mainstays of treatment. Sometimes we also include radiation for certain stages, typically more in the early stages. That can be with pelvic radiation, which is radiation to the entire pelvis, and that's typically given over the course of 5 to 6 weeks. So that's daily radiation versus radiating just the vagina, that's called vaginal brachytherapy, to reduce the risk of the cancer coming back to the vagina. And we've been able to show that if the cancer is localized to the uterus and has certain factors, that vaginal radiation can prevent most of those vaginal recurrences, and pelvic radiation is not needed, so also less side effects associated with that. Still, even though we remove the uterus, the most likely place for the cancer to come back is the vagina. So if at any point in the future there is vaginal spotting or bleeding or anything like that, definitely a reason to see your doctor again, because it could be that the cancer has a lesion in the vagina, which in most instances can still be very effectively treated with radiation in that case. As long as it's limited to the vagina and the pelvis. However, if the cancer comes back to other organs, then that would involve chemotherapy also, and Dr. Ramirez, I think, is going to go into some of the new treatments. As far as upfront and new treatment approaches, still this is kind of a combination of the radiation and chemotherapy and surgery. In some instances, if there is a change in your tumor called a mismatch repair deficiency, your doctor may also consider, and it's more an advanced stage, your doctor may also consider adding immunotherapy to the chemotherapy, and that is a fairly recent development to try and keep the cancer away. As far as treatment side effects from the surgery, that is the can be surgical pain, but when we do surgical minimally invasive surgery, that pain is oftentimes very limited. And I tell my patients that most patients actually, and they tell me that most patients don't even use any narcotics, or maybe just for the first 3 days or so, but otherwise do fine with Tylenol and ibuprofen, and recover quite well. And most patients after minimally invasive surgery are able to go home on the same day. That's a little bit different for if you have to have an open surgery or called a laparotomy. In that case, typically in the hospital for 2 to 4 days or so in most instances. And then for chemotherapy side effects, those are the more common side effects that we see with chemotherapy, but the combination of chemotherapy that we use called carboplatin and paclitaxel, those two chemotherapy drugs overall are quite well tolerated with without nausea, sometimes some queasiness, but we give good medications before and after chemotherapy to prevent that nausea also. So really, I tell my patients they really shouldn't be nauseated at all, and if they are, they need to call so that we can adjust those medications, because we have gotten so much better in the medications that we have available to prevent that nausea. Hair loss is unfortunately still unavoidable, but it will grow back after the treatment again, and hair loss usually starts about 3 weeks after the first treatment with chemotherapy. Other side effects such as numbness and tingling in the fingertips or toes is possible also. And of course, effects on the blood counts, white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets, so we monitor that really closely. Sometimes we see an allergic reaction to chemotherapy, and if that happens, we can still give the chemotherapy, but we have to give it much slower and monitor closely. And those are some of the most common side effects, and I think that kind of wraps up my time probably.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Backus. That was just a wonderful presentation, and because you're the first speaker, you kind of you set the tone, really, for today's program, so I thank you, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Paulina Ramirez. And Dr. Ramirez is a gynecology oncology fellow, UT Health San Antonio. And Dr. Ramirez will be addressing new treatment for metastatic endometrial cancer and the role of precision medicine, targeted treatments, and immunotherapy, guidelines to prepare for telehealth telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, quality of life concerns, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ramirez.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Excited to be here today and answer questions at the end of our presentation. Today I will speak about new treatments for metastatic endometrial cancer and the role of precision medicine and target therapies. I will also discuss tips on how to prepare for your telehealth appointments. Most women with endometrial cancer are diagnosed at an early stage. However, there are a subset of patients that have metastatic disease at the time of initial diagnosis or experience recurrence after initial treatment. Metastatic means that the endometrial cancer has spread outside of the uterus to different organs. This could include lymph nodes, liver, lungs, or the peritoneal lining of the abdomen, amongst other organs. Treatment of newly diagnosed metastatic endometrial cancer usually involves multiple modalities or types of treatment. We've already discussed a couple of those. Some patients, but mostly none, can be eligible for surgery, meaning that they have a surgery that removes all visible cancer if they have metastatic disease. So again, surgery is not typically recommended for patients who experience recurrent endometrial cancer that is metastatic. But again, all patients, whether they have a surgery or not, will receive systemic therapy. The standard systemic therapy for metastatic endometrial cancer is cytotoxic chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel. Sometimes there will be an additional medication added to this treatment depending on the genetic makeup of your cancer. Physicians use precision medicine to determine if patients will benefit from adding other medications to your standard chemotherapy. Precision medicine, or next-generation sequencing, uses the cancer's genetic makeup to guide treatment decisions. This means that a tumor biopsy is sent to a lab where the tumor's DNA is sequenced and specific protein analysis is performed. Knowing the DNA sequence and specific mutations helps us identify targeted therapy options for women with metastatic endometrial cancer. Immunotherapy can be considered a type of targeted therapy. For example, patients with mismatch repair deficiency or microsatellite instability high metastatic endometrial cancers are more likely to benefit from immunotherapy to chemotherapy. One of the main reasons why the body can't fight cancers on its own is that the body doesn't recognize the cancer as abnormal and therefore doesn't know how to attack it. Endometrial cancers that are mismatch repair deficient have lost the ability to fix mistakes on their own DNA. This results in a big commotion of DNA replication and creates more proteins that the body doesn't recognize as normal. The more abnormal proteins there are, the more likely the body's immune system is able to recognize and attack these cancer cells. There has been, as of recently, two practice-changing clinical trials published out last year for treatment of metastatic endometrial cancer. These trials demonstrated benefit of adding immune therapy to chemotherapy in subsets of patients with metastatic endometrial cancer. Oncologists also use precision medicine to identify patients who may be eligible for other targeted therapies such as trastuzumab and trastuzumab deruxtecan. These medications can be used in certain metastatic endometrial cancers that are overexpressed a protein called HER2-new that your oncologist will likely recommend testing for in the setting of metastatic or recurrent endometrial cancer. Women with metastatic endometrial cancer will often experience symptoms due to the cancer. These include but are not limited to pain, fatigue, weight loss, swelling, and loss of appetite. In addition to this, the treatment of metastatic endometrial cancer has numerous side effects. Side effects of chemotherapy can include hair loss, nausea, vomiting, body and joint pain, neuropathy, and fatigue. Women receiving immunotherapy specifically can also experience additional side effects that affect the intestines, the thyroid gland, lungs, liver, and skin. It is also very common for patients diagnosed with cancer to experience depression. It is important to communicate any bothersome symptoms to your oncology team. There are different interventions that can be trialed depending on the symptoms you're experiencing. Some, but not all, of the interventions include medications. I personally find that when patients benefit from having an oncology team that includes their treating oncologists, nurses, social workers, and other support, they do best. Additionally, women may benefit from seeing a palliative care team. Again, this is a team of physicians and nurses as well as other supporting services that focus on helping women manage symptoms that they're experiencing either either due to the cancer or the treatment. Metastatic cancer can sometimes cause severe pain that requires narcotic medications as well. It's normal to feel hesitant about taking pain meds. However, I remind my patients all the time that they have real pain, and that the intent of the medication is to help them function and live as a life as possible. Sleepiness can be a side effect of pain medications, and it's important to tell your physician if you're feeling like the medication is making you too tired. Whatever, it is also important for women to maintain quality of life as they go through cancer treatment. Providers can help with that as well. One of the ways technologies has helped with this as of recently is via telemedicine. It's become a convenient way to connect with a GYN oncologist from the comfort of your home to make the most of your appointments. To make the most of these visits, firstly, I try to remind my patients to prepare your technology. Make sure your electronic device is fully charged or plugged in, that you have a stable internet connection, and that you download the necessary software or app for the visit. These tips can eliminate the stress of the visit. And prior to your visit, I think it's also super helpful to think about topics and symptoms that you want to discuss. Creating a list with your family members and friends that can include any new symptoms or concerns, changes in medications or treatments, or any side effects you're experiencing. And specific questions about test results or referrals is very helpful. During your visit, and if you're interested, you can also discuss open notes and ask your provider if you could request access if you're not already using it, or provide any additional input or clarification to the notes that you have read. During your visit, I also recommend taking notes, because I think that way you can have a little record of what you've discussed with your provider to reflect on after the visit. Lastly, one other important thing that I'd like to emphasize is shared decision-making. People who take part in shared decision-making are more likely to get the care they want and feel overall satisfied. Patients are the experts for their body, so it is important to ask questions and talk openly about what is most important. For example, patients may want to delay or skip a treatment to travel or participate in a family event, and that is completely okay. In most instances, treatment schedules can be adjusted. Examples like this are ways in which the patient and oncologist can participate in shared decision-making to help meet the patient's goal. I encourage every patient to have an honest relationship with their oncologist and ask as many questions as possible. It is important for us to know how you're feeling and what your goals are. We are here to support you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ramirez. That was such a wonderful presentation. Very substantive, a lot of information for our participants. And I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Sarah Kerr. Dr. Kerr is a pathologist, hospital pathology associate, division of cytopathology, pulmonary gynecologic and molecular pathology, Alina Health Laboratories, Alina Health Cancer Institute. And Dr. Kerr will be addressing the important role of the pathologist, genetic and biomarker testing, the benefits of communicating with your healthcare team, and clinical trials, how research increases your treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kerr.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm so excited to go into more depth about pathology and how some of the new biomarkers are informing the pathology diagnosis and also the staging in endometrial cancer, as well as communicating with your healthcare team about pathology results and clinical trials to help with shared decision-making. So first of all, I'm a pathologist, which is a doctor who specializes in laboratory testing. So in endometrial cancer, your pathologist is involved in your care behind the scenes. Many of you had an endometrial biopsy at the beginning of your endometrial cancer journey, and that endometrial biopsy goes to the pathology laboratory where the tissue is processed into these little blocks of wax, and then it gets cut into thin sections that are put onto these small glass slides for the pathologist to look at under a microscope. The pathologist recognizes whether there's cancer there in the endometrium or there's something else that might be causing abnormal vaginal bleeding, like abnormal menstrual cycles or an infection or a polyp. But if there's cancer, the pathologist needs to make sure it's coming from the endometrium and not somewhere else like the cervix, because the treatments for endometrial and cervical cancer are very different. But if it is endometrial cancer, there are a number of types and grades of endometrial cancer that are important to determining therapy. A cancer called phygograde 1 endometrioid carcinoma, for example, is usually a slow-growing cancer that could potentially even be treated with hormonal treatments when caught early, especially in some patients that need to delay surgery for health or fertility reasons. This being said, most endometrial cancers, as has been talked about, are managed with surgery. So endometrioid carcinoma, clear cell carcinoma, serous carcinoma, or carcinosarcoma are some of the types of endometrial cancer you might hear about, and these are almost always managed with surgery if possible. So when that surgery is performed, the tissue is removed by the surgeon and is also sent to the pathology laboratory, where a team that's led by the pathologist examines the tissue, both just with a naked eye and also under a microscope. And then a pathology report is made with that final tumor diagnosis and the staging describing how far the cancer has spread, if it's spread. So something that's pretty new that you might be reading about in your pathology reports is the molecular classification of endometrial cancer. The molecular classification now helps your team refine what the expected behavior of the cancer might be And also in some cases now affects the FIGO stage that we assign for the cancer. So pathologists for years have classified endometrial cancer just with a microscope and special stains alone. But now these biomarkers that are used can help provide even better information about the endometrial cancer beyond what we can tell just by looking at under the microscope. So the most common tests now are POLE mutation testing, which is sometimes reported with what's called a tumor mutation burden, mismatch repair enzymes, and P53 status. And I'll go through each of these individually. So using these three tests, POLE, mismatch repair, and P53, a tumor can be given a molecular classification. And you might read about this as called the PROMIS classifier, which stands for Proactive Molecular Risk Classifier for Endometrial Cancer, or PROMIS. The molecular classification divides cancers into POLE mutant, or also called ultra-mutated, mismatch repair deficient, or also called microsatellite instability high, P53 abnormal, or also called serous-like or copy number high, or a fourth category called no specific molecular profile. So the POLE mutant tumors make up only about 5% of endometrial cancers, so they're relatively rare. And they have a defect in one of the enzymes that's needed for accurate DNA replication in dividing cells. So when this enzyme isn't working due to a mutation, the tumor accumulates a huge number of mistakes in the DNA, which is why they're called ultra-mutated or tumor mutation burden high tumors. These mistakes in the tumor make the tumor more recognizable to the immune system. So the thought is that these tumors are easier to treat because the body itself is using the immune system to recognize and contain the tumor. POLE mutant tumors can look very scary or high grade under the microscope, but they may not behave as aggressively as they look. So because of this, having that POLE mutation result could now result in a lower tumor stage than otherwise would be assigned based on the pathology evaluation alone. So for example, a POLE mutant tumor that's invading to any extent but confined to the uterus is still considered the lowest stage of 1A. Your oncologist might take this into consideration in your treatment plan if you have a POLE mutant tumor, or they might recommend a clinical trial for you depending on the situation. Now, the next category, mismatch repair deficient tumors, are similar to POLE immune tumors in that an enzyme that's needed to fix mistakes during DNA replication isn't working right. And these tumors, sometimes called microsatellite unstable, describe specific types of mistakes that accumulate in the DNA and proteins of the tumor. And the number of mutations in mismatch repair deficient tumors is not as high as in POLE immune tumors, but they still have a relatively high tumor mutation burden, and the immune system can still recognize the differences in the tumor from the body. And as Dr. Ramirez had described, this can be used to help treat mismatch repair deficient tumors with immunotherapy. So some mismatch repair deficient tumors are found in patients with an inherited syndrome called Lynch syndrome, which means that there's a familial mutation in the family that is associated with a gene in the mismatch repair pathway and can cause a predisposition to developing endometrial cancer, colon cancer, and some other tumors. So patients with mismatch repair deficient tumors will undergo genetic testing to determine if they have a mutation in the family. And these patients and families with Lynch syndrome can undergo special screening and surgeries to catch cancers early or prevent cancers from starting. Okay, so the third type The third molecular type that you might see in a report is P53 abnormal or TP53 abnormal. These are usually serous carcinomas under the microscope or carcinosarcomas, but sometimes the tumor under the microscope can look more like an endometrioid or clear cell carcinoma and still be P53 abnormal. So P53 abnormal tumors tend to behave more aggressively, and your oncologist may consider more aggressive treatment if you have a P53 abnormal tumor, or may recommend a clinical trial. It's also important to note that serous carcinomas and P53 abnormal tumors sometimes have a positive marker called HER2, as was previously described. And when serous carcinomas are positive for HER2, they basically produce too much of the HER2 protein, usually due to having too many copies of the gene. And these HER2-positive tumors can potentially be treated with targeted therapy similar to what is used for HER2-positive breast cancers. So also, like for POLE, staging can be sometimes revised for P53 abnormal tumors compared to how they used to be staged. But for P53 abnormal tumors, they actually get upstaged based on the P53 abnormal status in some cases. So for example, if you have a P53 abnormal tumor that is, you know, relatively small and confined to the uterus, but there's just a little myometrial invasion, we used to consider that to be an early stage 1A tumor, but now that'll get staged in the report as a 2C tumor. Rather than a stage one. And the staging committees who put together the new staging criteria did that due to a higher risk of recurrence for those tumors. And then I'll just briefly cover the fourth molecular type, which is the rest of endometrial cancers with no specific molecular profile. And these cancers are actually the most common type of endometrial cancer. They tend to be endometrioid carcinomas, and we still have just a real lot to learn about this group. Sometimes these cancers are estrogen receptor positive, which can be a really important characteristic that your oncologist can use to give you hormone-altering medications to help with controlling tumor growth, especially if the tumor is slow-growing or recurs after standard treatments like chemotherapy and radiation therapy. We're still learning about this, but there are also some no specific molecular profile tumors that have alterations in specific genes like beta-catenin, which can be associated with potentially more aggressive behavior than other similar looking tumors. So we still have a lot to learn about this group, which is most of endometrial cancers. Okay, so that was a lot about endometrial cancer pathology, and this information is changing so quickly. And we're learning a lot about how to try to individualize treatments for each patient based on both the traditional pathology combined with that molecular profile. So that's really exciting. All of these pathology, biomarker, and staging details can be really overwhelming to understand, even if you have a good medical background. And because some of these biomarkers are pretty new, it's likely that your doctors are also learning how to use some of these biomarkers and especially how they affect staging. So I encourage you to ask a lot of questions about your pathology report, including understanding how your tumor would have been treated or staged without the new biomarker information. It's also important to note that clinical trials may be open to you based on the biomarker profile of your tumor. So ask your team what may be available to you that could offer a different option for treatment than otherwise might be standard of care. So for clinical trials, there might be some that your team already participates in close to home, and your team will know the most about whether those trials could be a good fit for you. If you have the means and the motivation to travel for a clinical trial, you might have the opportunity to go for an opinion from a different cancer team where the trial is located. Now, clinical trials might not offer a better treatment than the standard of care, but participating in a clinical trial could give you a larger number of options to choose from with your team. And participating could help doctors globally understand endometrial cancer and best treatments for the future. Okay, so that's all I have for today. Thanks so much. I'm turning the conference back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. That was really a fabulous presentation. And I think many people don't get a chance to hear a pathologist present as you do. And so they've learned a great deal, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. But thank you for that stellar presentation, as always. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Corby Arthur. Ms. Arthur is an endometrial cancer patient, share uterine cancer, and website as well. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Arthur.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction, Carolyn. We're very pleased to have the opportunity to partner with Cancer Care on today's educational program. SHARE is a national nonprofit that supports, educates, and empowers women affected by uterine, ovarian, cervical, and breast cancers. Our uterine cancer program, which covers both endometrial cancer and uterine sarcoma, offers a variety of free services. We have five different peer-led uterine cancer support groups, which are currently being held via Zoom. So support groups are a low-pressure, empowering opportunity to exchange experiences, information, and care with other women who have been affected by uterine cancer. The first group is a general uterine cancer support group. We also have a group for women of African descent, as well as a group for women who are newly diagnosed and in treatment. This past year, we started a support group for people with metastatic uterine cancer. Lastly, we have a young women's gynecological cancer support group, which was designed for women diagnosed under the age of 40 with either uterine, ovarian, or cervical cancer. And we also now have support groups for women who speak Spanish or Chinese. Our helpline is staffed by trained uterine cancer survivors who can lend support and give information and share their experiences. The number is 844-582-6005. We also have educational webinars as well as additional programming throughout the year, including events like today's, where we partner with another organization. Our webinars provide the latest information about endometrial and uterine cancer research and treatment, as well as strategies for maintaining well-being and quality of life, and are led by top oncologists and experts in the field. All webinars are recorded and can be found on our website, sharecancersupport.org. For information on our uterine cancer programs, you can get the information in patient-friendly language. Thank you, Carolyn, for inviting us.
Thank you so much, Ms. Arthur, and it's a wonderful resource. And for those of you who haven't used it, please take advantage of it. And actually, I should tell you that at the end of probably early next week, you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation. And that evaluation is an evaluation of the program, but you also will get all the resources that are mentioned during the program. So stay tuned. If you don't have the resources, we will provide them for you. And our next speaker is Ms. Cassie Spector. And Ms. Spector is an oncology social worker. She's our breast and gynecological cancer program coordinator at Cancer Care. And she'll be discussing Cancer Care's free programs and services and our Hope Line and website information as well.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As Dr. Messner mentioned, my name is Cassie Spector, and I'm the Breast and Gynecological Cancers Program Coordinator, as well as an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. In my role at Cancer Care, I provide supportive services to individuals and families impacted by a cancer diagnosis. as well as develop programs and initiatives for those impacted by a breast or gynecological cancer diagnosis. Individuals diagnosed with endometrial cancer may choose to supplement existing social networks by joining a support group or engaging in counseling. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services. Being a member of a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through similar experiences, obtain information, and also provide support. Currently, CancerCare offers a gynecological cancer support group. The gynecological cancer's online support group aims to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, increase feelings of empowerment, provide practical information about treatment and resources, and address ways to communicate with one's medical team. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by oncology social workers who provide support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and group members must register online on our website to join. You can register by going to CancerCare's website, cancercare.org, and selecting our services and then clicking on support groups. After completing the registration process on our website, members can participate by posting in the groups 24/7. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout one's treatment. Please know if you're encountering such financial hardships, there are organizations that may be able to assist you. CancerCare offers resource navigation services, which offer a short-term, strength-based approach for both patients and caregivers affected by cancer nationally. A trained specialist will work with the client, connecting with them with resources, referrals, and financial assistance. If you're interested in learning more about our support services, I encourage you to call CancerCare's National Hopeline at 800-813-4673 to speak to one of our oncology social workers. At CancerCare, our oncology social workers are trained to be able to assist you in navigating practical challenges, emotional challenges, and be able to offer you support. We look forward to hearing from you. It's been a pleasure to be part of this program. Thank you so much, and I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Spector. That was just a wonderful presentation and wonderful resources. And again, we'll be sending you all that information in the SurveyMonkey, so you'll have it as well and just in front of you. So if you haven't taken advantage of those services, you'll be able to. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to queue up for questions. So I'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question for Dr. Backus. Please address treatment options for clear cell carcinoma without DMMR.
Sure. I'm going to assume that this is then since, two ways. So clear cell carcinoma, most of those, we see that as a more aggressive type of tumor. So most of those patients will be offered after surgery, if it's diagnosed at surgery, then will be offered chemotherapy to decrease the risk of a distant recurrence, so the cancer come back in outside of the pelvis. But also oftentimes these cancers can be more can be less sensitive to chemotherapy and can be sensitive to radiation also. That radiation also is an option to radiate the pelvis to decrease the risk of the cancer coming back to the pelvis or the vagina. If the situation is a cancer that has come back and that is clear cell cancer and has metastasized afterwards, and if you have not received any chemotherapy in the past yet, then that would be treated with chemotherapy with carboplatin paclitaxel and with the addition of immunotherapy. And if you have received immunotherapy, so there's a lot of different scenarios, and if you have already received chemotherapy up front after the surgery to try and prevent it, but it still came back, in that case, it oftentimes will be a combination of a drug called pembrolizumab, which is an immunotherapy agent combined with an agent that works on the blood vessels to the tumors called lenvatinib. So those are some options for those, but it really depends on the scenario, whether it's untreated or previously treated, what we would go with next.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Kerr. How subjective is the pathology review?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's really ideal to have your pathology read by a group that has multiple pathologists. One of the requirements for a new diagnosis of endometrial cancer is to have two pathologists look at it. And so even though there is some subjectivity in sort of the way our brains recognize what a cancer looks like, if you have multiple pathologists look at it, it sort of decreases that subjectivity by having a consensus. Another thing that pathologists use to try to reduce that subjectivity and provide more accurate quality to reports is having multidisciplinary conferences with oncologists where the pathology is reviewed, usually by a pathologist who wasn't the one who made the diagnosis, so there's that quality check. And so, yes, even though, I mean, pathologists have to sort of use their brain image library to classify cancers based on, you know, sort of criteria that have been described based on cell size and the way the cells are arranged on a slice section through the tumor, we do have some ways of decreasing that subjectivity. The other thing I would say is that the new biomarkers also help us to have sort of other ways of being objective about classifying cancers. So we think that these new biomarkers used in that PROMIS classifier that I described sometimes take out some the subjectivity or mistakes that pathologists used to make when they're looking at a cancer under the microscope. And so these biomarkers add some level of objectivity to that cancer diagnosis as well. So yeah, it's a challenge, but we do have some techniques that we use to try to be the most accurate we can.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Ramirez. Is there any research being done to better understand the increase in younger women being diagnosed with endometrial cancer?
Definitely. There's a lot of research being done focused on understanding why women that are of younger age are developing endometrial cancer. Particularly because endometrial cancer was previously thought to be a disease that one of the risk factors was age, and older age specifically. So some of the research is focused on particularly looking at how obesity is associated with endometrial cancer. And we know that obesity increases the risk of endometrial cancer up to 7 times more. And unfortunately, obesity is something that is a rising epidemic, not just nationally, but internationally. And perhaps one of the reasons why we are seeing a rise in endometrial cancer in younger women. But it's definitely something that we're continuously looking at because we've noticed an uptrend on younger women getting endometrial cancer.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm going to ask all of our speakers to provide some takeaways from today's program. I'm going to start with Dr. Backus.
I think for the most important part really is to talk to your doctor ask a lot of questions. There's lots of options available. It was mentioned before also, especially if the cancer has come back, there's a lot of new drugs available. There's a lot of new drugs in clinical trials that are really promising. So ask your doctors also about those clinical trials. They provide really exciting options. We have some more agents now for patients who have endometrial cancer that's come back, but a lot of them are still in development, and that's really how we've made progress. And those drugs often turn out to be better than what we have as standard of care. So don't just accept if your doctor says, yes, we'll go to this second line or third line standard of care treatments, but really go look for that clinical trial.
Well, thank you so much. Excellent takeaway. And Dr. Ramirez?
Yes, thank you. So I think importantly is as a patient, knowing your body and advocating for yourself when you think there's something that's going on that is abnormal. So just as Dr. Bax explained, bleeding. So as women, we know, you know, we get our periods and then we go into menopause and then sometimes we continue bleeding and we may be too uncomfortable sharing that with our family or friends, but it's something that we definitely need to bring up to our providers, our benign gynecologists, as soon as we experience it so that we can further investigate and hopefully try to diagnose endometrial cancer at an early stage. But as we've covered today, there's, you know, this disease is very heterogeneous, meaning it's ever evolving, and as well as consistently the treatment options that are available and for our patients. So definitely advocate for yourself, advocate for your body, and make sure that you bring up the symptoms that you're experiencing as soon as you experience them, and know that there is treatment options available. This is a very treatable disease.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Kerr, your takeaway?
Yeah, so something that's really evolved through my career as a pathologist is electronic medical records, and we've been really grateful to be able to see pathology reports across multiple healthcare systems if you, you sign the paperwork to share your medical records when you sort of travel between healthcare systems. But sometimes there's still gaps in us being able to know all of your medical records. And so what I really recommend to cancer patients, especially for pathology reports and biomarker testing, is even though I think it can be really overwhelming, try to stay organized and keep those records in some way, either electronically or on paper, so that if you're, you know, God forbid you happen to have a recurrence that needs to have a biopsy, that prior information is available to your pathologist. It's going to make their diagnosis more accurate and more timely if they know that prior information. So I really encourage keeping good records throughout your cancer journey.
Well, thank you so much. That's an excellent recommendation. And Ms. Corby.
Hi. Our takeaway is knowledge is power, and SHARE Uterine Cancer Support is here for you. So give us a call.
Thank you. And Ms. Spector.
Thank you. I would say my takeaway, similar to SHARE, would be knowing that there's support available to you, whether you're looking for practical support, financial support, emotional support. There's organizations there to assist you. Go to your treatment team, talk to them about what resources might be available in your area, and know that you can always reach out to Cancer Care or other organizations that can assist you.
Cool. Thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers and our participants. Our participants really asked great questions. And our speakers were phenomenal, too. Both participants and speakers were wonderful, and the questions were terrific on today's program, I have to say. Just a wonderful job that everyone did. And, you know, although we've done a program on this before, I have to say that this particular program was really outstanding, phenomenal, actually, in the sense of that synergy between our great speakers and our great participants. So I want to thank all of you. But I do want to comment on those of you who asked a question and those of you who have a question yet in queue. For both groups, I would recommend that you go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them the question that you asked during the program today, or for those in queue, that you take your question and ask it of your healthcare team. Remember, they know you the best. They have access to your medical records, and they actually can help you with your question. And ask it as often as you need to, or any other question you need to ask, because, again, the more questions you ask, the more you learn. And the more programs that you listen to or participate in groups or in educational workshops, the more you'll learn. That's really important as well. Be sure, though, you listen to groups that are well vetted and that are, you know, that are national organizations, and that, you know, I wouldn't quote from information from a blog, but I would take it from actually a vetted, you know, national organization that really looks at everything very carefully. Also, most importantly, many people have a difficult time reaching their physicians evenings, weekends, and holidays. And with the holiday season soon upon us, actually, it's really important for you to find out from your healthcare team who's available evenings, weekends, and particularly holidays. so that you know who to call if you run into any difficulties at those times. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.